So, welcome to Scanners. Thank you all for coming. We're a one-month bookstore dedicated to highlighting the book as a physical object in an increasingly dematerialized world. This is our third event. We have two more events coming up this week end. Tomorrow night at 6:30 is an artist talk with Brenda Glaser and David King. It's going to be a talk on their source material. And on October 23rd, that Sunday at 5 p.m., the psychologist Patricia Greenfield from UCLA will give a talk on how reading affects your brain and behavior. And then the following Friday on the 28th will be another artist talk with D.L. Alvarez and Coulter Jacobson. And so we're open only for the month of October, so we have 10 days left, and then we will be gone forever. Tonight is our event is on the future of the archive, and it fits into our project quite well because in trying to highlight the book as an object. We're doing something in a way similar to what archives have traditionally done, which has always dealt with preserving some form of material culture. Of course, this is now changing. And the rise of the digital has complicated this in some ways, and it also has brought up different issues. And so tonight we want to talk to two archivists about the different issues that are facing archives in this digital era. So I'd like to introduce our two speakers tonight. We have, right to my right, is Tanya Hollis, who is currently employed as an archivist at the Labor Archives and Research Center at San Francisco State. Her former positions include literary collections archivist and environmental collections archivist at the Bancroft Library at Berkeley and manuscripts librarian at the California Historical Society. She holds a master's in library science from the State University of New York at Buffalo and a BA in religion from New College of Florida. Tanya is also a visual artist and a founding member of the Non-Site Collective. And Rick Prelinger is an archivist, writer, filmmaker, and founder of the Prelinger Archives, which is a collection of 60,000 advertising, educational, industrial, and amateur films. 2,000 of which, or almost 2,000 of which, are available on the Internet Archive. And this archive was acquired by the Library of Congress in 2002. Rick is also the co-founder of the Prelinger Library, which is an appropriation-friendly reference library located in San Francisco. He has worked for the Comedy Channel, HBO, and taught at the New York School of Visual Arts. He is currently president of the board of the Internet Archive. So thank you both for coming, and thank you all for coming. We have quite a full house to talk about archives. It's pretty amazing. But I wanted to start with just some very basic questions. And first, I was hoping you could both give us sort of an overview or a description of the archives that you work in now. So what's in them, what you do with them, maybe a little history.
So I work out at the Labor Archives and Research Center out at San Francisco State University. I've just started there in January. I worked a little bit before that. The Labor Archives is mainly a collection of materials that were aggregated for and by the unions. I would say that the bulk of the collection are union collections, but also we have legal records from lawyers that represent that constituency, also pamphlets, other materials, lots of great visual artifacts that document labor and the struggle of labor. And what we do is we do serve that population, the rank and file of the unions. We also serve the students and the faculty of San Francisco State. And we serve scholars from all over the world who are interested in the struggles of labor. Is that enough? I've worked at other institutions in the Bay Area, so I have other things that I'm going to bring in from those institutions as well, that experience. But I'll defer to Rick.
I started not as an archivist, but as a collector of kind of uncollected genres of film and moving images back in the 80s, industrial, advertising, educational films, home movies, etc. And it took me a number of years to figure out exactly what I was doing and the value of it. But then I realized that I was practicing public history without a diploma. And I tried to find a permanent home for our collection because I was worried about getting old or walking in front of a bus or something. And it's always a kind of a Faustian bargain in one way or another, but it ended up in Library of Congress. And concurrently, we put a lot of material online at the Internet Archive, which was life-changing and led me to challenge a lot of issues about access to collections and what role cultural materials, archival materials actually play in our contemporary lived experience. And after that, I became kind of a meta-archivist, to kind of try to bring a lot of these issues about archives into the public sphere. And now I still collect, but primarily home movies, because home movies are the most interesting to me documents, and they actually not only challenge the content of moving image archives, but they challenge the workflow, the theory, all kinds of things. They're like collecting jellyfish or something. They're just absolutely wonderful.
The issue of what role do archives play in public life, I think, is a really important one. And I think that leads to my next question, which is a very broad one, stepping back from specifics of what is in any one individual archive, and just to ask, what is the purpose of an archive, why are archives important?
I mean, I remember, so Nick and I have been talking about this for months. We keep meeting randomly over coffee to have discussions. And part of my initial conversation with him was about sort of this misperception that archives are only about precious objects or literary manuscripts or things that are very beautiful objects that we want to preserve for our cultural heritage. And they are that. That's a large part of what we do. But what we also do is we support the underpinnings of a democracy. If you don't have open archives and public access to those archives, you have a police state, essentially, which we kind of do. There's lots of stuff behind that barrier already. So I think that my big issue is what archives are for is to preserve freedom in this sort of vast, giant way, but also at the very micro level to preserve the daily history of us as humans. I mean, the output of our daily work and labor is what is the meat and bones in the archive, and what makes it actually more relevant, I think, to us on a daily basis. It isn't until we have run-ins with the state that we need it to serve this larger purpose of openness and transparency. When democracy becomes sort of caged off and closed off from us is when we start questioning why these things aren't available to us. So in the larger sense, we're trying to preserve the record of who we are as a people, but also where our government is, what they're doing and what they're producing and what they're doing behind our backs that we don't know about.
That's great. Thank you for saying that. My points may seem trivial next to that. I have like four sort of bullet points. One, archives are or should be seen as cultural producers. We make culture in the same way that the culture industry does. We're actually part of the culture industry. In England, you know, they've got all this bizarre language from the Thatcher period about the heritage industry and the memory industry, and I won't go that far, but we are part of that apparatus. Second, archival work is civic activity. It's social practice. I hope that most archivists are able to come and think of their work in that way. There's a bunch of people in this room who already do. But archives are civic institutions. Third, archives are places of origin. You know, the story that really taught me that was when I met a cinema studies teacher who said that she was trying to get her cinema studies grad students interested in moving image archives, and she said they didn't care. And I said, why? And she said, it's because they thought archives were where films go to die. And, you know, archives should be the point of origin. They should be the place where old works are reborn and new works are born, and which ties into point four, which is that archives are classically thought of as places where things are kept and stored, in other words, repositories. But one of the things we've discovered with our library is that if you begin to reframe the repository as a workshop, as a place where actually people make work, if the archive is a studio, a laboratory, a factory, an experimental farm, whatever you want to call it, then some really phenomenally interesting things happen, which goes back to the cultural producer's point. So there's a little circle.
Could you say more about what you mean by the civic activity or social practice? Is that just what all those points combined, or is that something different?
Well, you know, I think Tanya kind of said it, that the archives are both, they're at best a defense against authoritarianism. They're a place potentially of accountability. I'd also like to see them as a place where people actively, mobilize historical materials to intervene. The phrase I've sometimes used is make historical interventions. And when you have collections that actually push material out to the public and don't just wait for the email or the fax to provide access, then really, really interesting things can happen. Lots of archives do this right now, but far too few. It's hard. It's not easy.
Well, so given that importance, And it seems like any archivist I've ever spoken to or librarian there's always just this incredible funding crunch. There's just always a lack of funds, lack of space. There's never enough to do your job well. But I'm wondering if, assuming that these problems are still existing, I'm wondering though, are there new problems now? With the onset of the digital era, are there new problems with in terms of more the amount of material that you have to deal with, or with perceptions by the public, or issues of access?
I would say all of those things. Certainly, as things become more and more available online, there's an expectation that everything is online and that we're going to be able to magically push everything out there. And what we can push out there and we don't even have shoestring budgets. We don't have laces in our boots. I mean, there's nobody in the back room a lot of these places, or there's one person who's doing all of it. So what you're trying to do is control an ever-growing amount of paper. The more that we have digital sort of forms of everything we produce that are infinitely reproducible, I've been in collections where they just instantly print four copies of anything and shove it in the box, and so you think about a 19th century manuscript collection might be two boxes because paper was so scarce and so difficult to come by, and who had the luxury of writing volumes at that time. And now, that same individual might donate, 20 cartons of material. And whether that value is transferable too. I mean, sometimes the smaller collection had a lot more to say than the large one. But I think that, to get back to your question of resources, we're still dealing with that giant mound of paper in the back room, and then to push it outward is a whole nother pressure from our public, and definitely a good pressure we all want to meet that demand. I think that we're all trying very hard. The funding comes from places like the federal government, the NHPRC, NEH grants, those kinds of things, and then you get to digitize, say like 200 things from a 20,000 image collection, and are you really doing much? I mean, you're really kind of throwing something out there in the hopes that someone sees what you have and then says, well, I want to see the rest of it. So we're always sort of running, I would say, to put things out there. But the resources are not going to get any better. And I think they're cutting. The NHPRC is getting cut as we speak, probably. So those things are not going to get better for archives. If anything, the demand for more digital is going to be sort of trumping what we do in the back rooms to actually process the material, to actually get the paper out there. And so it's, but I'm in the back room sort of end, and Rick is maybe on the other end of that. So.
So, you bring up a lot of really interesting questions. Maybe we can talk about the question about, do physical objects have rights, the right to exist. But I wanted to get back to what you said, about the money thing. I mean, we'll never have the money we need to pursue archival work properly. It's just not going to happen. We live in a society that essentially looks forward, and somewhere in the back of our minds, all of our minds, there's this fantasy that one day there's going to be a priesthood of people who will live somewhere and who will dedicate their lives generation after generation. They'll reproduce in petri dishes or something, and they'll be and they will protect our history, and they will carry migrate from one format to the other, and it's not going to happen. And I really think, the issue isn't just money, it's control. So most archivists, including most of the archivists with good ideas, work in organizations where they don't make the big financial decisions. They can't go out and raise money themselves. They have to ask permission to expose something to the public quite often. They don't have control over their own destiny or the destiny of their collections. And if we started to think about, if we were goal-oriented rather than sort of procedure-oriented, taking the logic of step A to step B, I think we would figure out different ways to spend the budgets that we have. And it's extremely knotty problem. But we're just going to have to, we're going to have to do a lot more with less. And find unorthodox ways to do it. And if it means breaking rules, some rules are going to have to be broken. And at the end of the, later on, I'd like to propose one great rule we could break together.
No, I totally agree with you, Rick. There's going to have to be a paradigm shift, because there's just no way to do what we've been traditionally doing and get through all this stuff and actually push it out there. There's just no way.
Especially the paper.
Yeah.
So is that because there's too much stuff right now? I mean, I guess I've lost track of what the exact issue. There's too much stuff and not enough money, is that change from?
There was never enough staff, but there was a lot less material, and now there's a lot more stuff. And like I was saying, it's sort of, as people have. I mean, now people can self-publish, people can have reams of paper that they can just print. I remember actually wading through someone's email where they had printed all their spam for, 20 years and sold it to the archive by the linear foot. So when you're thinking about collections in those terms, like linear footage, the old collection used to be a linear foot, and now, we get 150 linear feet from one individual sometimes. So, it's a matter of scale, and it's not like the staff in the back room is getting bigger and bigger. It's getting more winnowed down as the budgets and the state, implodes. We're all going to end up sort of losing the ability to take care of that material as it comes in. But what I would like to say is, if we have a paradigm shift, like Rick was suggesting, maybe we don't deal with it the same way that we've always dealt with it, and maybe it goes straight out the way it came in, and we sort of change our roles as preservers or gatekeepers into something else. Zookeepers.
Zookeepers. Yeah, zookeepers. So So, you know, my response to that is, yes, this is the situation in one kind of archive, but there are many different kinds of potential archives, and we have to view this this is extremely elastic. You know, if you're a French philosopher, you might believe that the archive envelops us, you know, like a gas, and that there's just different nodes in it. That's a continuum. At this point, I would like to put in some product placement for a free download, which is... The Selected Papers of Robert C. Binkley, you know, Mary there, who has discovered Robert C. Binkley by herself as well. This is a very interesting modern European historian who died at the age of 40, but he was the guy who thought up all kinds of technological advances about dealing with information. He came up with the idea about employing unemployed white-collar workers to do archival indexes, newspaper indexes, organized collections during the 30s. But he's like a total... He's an exponent of the idea of citizen scholarship and citizen historians, and he speaks very eloquently of how ordinary people can collect stuff that libraries and archives never would be able to do, and how we've got to get out of this institutional bias. And I was going to read like maybe one sentence about his idea of, he didn't like cultural centralization. He didn't like institutions. He says, from Germany comes the lesson of what things may be possible when cultural centralization is too great. But he said, for America, let there be included among our objectives not only a bathroom in every home and a car in every garage, but a scholar in every schoolhouse and a man of letters in every town. Toward this end, technology offers new devices and points the way. So he was saying embrace the new media of the 30s, which were microfilm, mimeograph, you know, wire recorders and things like that. Essentially, he's imagining the internet. But he's saying the action is going to happen outside institutional walls. And in fact, in my field, in moving images, you don't look to the Library of Congress or the National Archives for innovation. You look to the regional collections, like Northeast Historic in Maine, or like the SF State TV News Library, which had no money, and a very entrepreneurial man took a job there for essentially free and raised money to get a scanner and to begin to put stuff online. And for the first time in years, that collection is beginning to sing, and it's a tremendous resource. So lots of possibilities.
So you bring up so it sounds like, what's the fellow's name there?
Robert Binkley. Free download at the Internet Archive, by the way.
So yeah, the free download and the microfilm and making things scans available on the internet bring up another big question that maybe, Rick, I think you said earlier, you might think is overplayed a bit, but I think it's something that deserves our attention here, which is a reliance on technology when an older technology has proven to be a far more stable form of retention. So you look at you have the example, say, of the Nicholson Baker, you know, newspaper story. Or you have this example of the census, the 1960 census, some of that data being lost and the government having to work for 19 years to undertake this massive engineering project to get it back. Or you have, here is an example, of 10 to 20% of vital data tapes from the Viking Mars mission that have significant errors because magnetic tape is too susceptible to degradation to serve as an archival storage medium. So the reliance on technology, or the hope that technology will, it definitely brings access to the fore, but there seems like there's also a huge cost. I wonder if you could both speak to that.
Yeah, I guess there's no medium that's permanent. Paper is not permanent, and microfilm is not permanent, and faxes are gone already. So it's kind of this long-term view of what you see. I mean, you see this I think that Rick is right. There is a little bit of hysteria that things will not last in the mediums that we're using right this minute. But, you know, in the long view, I see lots of mediums that have fallen by the wayside along the way, and the data that was on them is gone as well. Looking at you know, the early thermal fax paper and seeing nothing there, and realizing what it might as well have been written in invisible ink. So to pretend that like one thing is more stable than the others is, you know, the whole 20th century is pretty unstable, both politically and medium-wise.
So I guess maybe I would just add that if you were replacing, so the Nicholson-Baker example is an example where we're replacing one medium that seems more stable with one that's less, maybe I'm wrong, but...
Sure. I mean, we don't, you know, people are pretty much aren't doing that anymore. It was a mistake, except all the libraries. Well, for example, okay, this is the rights of physical objects, right? So we lost most newspapers. There's very few. There's a lot of newspapers no longer exist in hard copy. A lot of records like invoices and personal records and birth certificates no longer exist in hard copy. We are starting to lose books because many small colleges, especially religious and local institutions, can't afford to keep books that nobody's looking at. So when they find out they're being scanned somewhere, they junk them. Periodicals are being junked. Videotape is coming next because you can oversample videotape when you digitize it secretly. Film is being thrown away, although nobody will publicly admit it. There's a real interesting question there. But, you know, I'm not an existentialist, but this is like a classic existentialist dilemma. Archivists are going to do an exceptional job under deep constraints. But on the other hand, I have to say, we should never intentionally try to lose something or try to destroy something. War, by the way, has destroyed a lot more documents than bit rot in the 20th century and 21st. But history is loss is formative. Historical the urge to do history is fed by absence and by loss and by desire to fill in the blanks. History of the American working class, history of peoples of color in America. So much of the work that's been done in the past few years has been fed by the sense that this history is very hard to find and hard to come by. And, you know, we do the best we can, but we can't save everything. And quite often the decisions we make are ridiculous in retrospect. You know, if you look at some of the retention schedules from the National Archives about what they're going to save, when the Universal Studios gave their newsreel to the American people and put it in the public domain, the only one of the five major theatrical newsreels that was made available to the public, the National Archives put out this amazing sheet. We will keep, you know, records of American state activity, diplomatic visits, acts of Congress. You know, we will not keep the diaper derbies. We will not keep Levittown. We will not keep alternate takes of Lead Belly, which came out of the March of Time. And, you know, these decisions look ludicrous today. And so our best intentions are quite often, they don't hold up.
So how do those ideas relate to this sort of widespread belief that we're saving absolutely everything with digital? That we have this, that some, I've read some historians say, like, worry about this issue that what are we going to do, what are historians of the future going to do when they have a virtually complete record of everything that happened in what, you know, over this period? Is that just ridiculous, or do we have to actually make choices to get rid of stuff, or will that just happen naturally?
I think actually Rick can probably speak to this more, but are you saying that historians of the future will have access to everything at all points, basically by virtue of it all being preserved digitally?
There's just a notion
that we live in a digital era.
That the digital is forever. I guess for me, the
idea of digital being forever is that it's not. I mean, it's you know, this much of history on top of eons, but also just that it seems very fleeting. And we had a quick talk about this, and that digital is tied in our age to capital in many ways, and capital is fleeting. We've all lost lots of capital lately, and so the idea that somehow these corporations that are holding our data are going to hold on, you know, there's no mandate there for them to hold on to what we produce, or there's, so some of it will, I think it's going to be a scattershot as the history we have now. You know, some of it's going to get saved, some of it's not, some of it wasn't worth saving to begin with, and, you know, some of it was, and it got lost. I think that's kind of...
We have a funny way of eternalizing the present. You know, we think that the way we think that it's called presentism in history. We think that because things are organized a certain way right now, that it's always going to be that way. And of course, you know, the history can turn on a dime, as we're finding out. Who would have predicted, you know, Occupy Together in all these cities just a month or two ago? And it really. Puts the lie to all sorts of commentary about the nature of American resistance and so on. We have a really weird attitude towards digital stuff. It's like half of us embrace it, or a percentage of us, especially around here, embrace it kind of uncritically. And then on the other side, there's people for whom it's a horrible, horrible thing. I saw this amazing poll. I think it was a Democratic Party deep poll last spring about sort of where Americans stood on the social issue agenda. And one of the things that came out is that some like 60 to 70% of people in the United States are scared of the internet. And you can see why, right? I mean, the disruptive aspect of the internet is tremendously frightening to people who have held on to traditional practices and traditional ideas when so much has been taken away from them. And this is no less true in the archival world. We have a moral panic right now about, you know, history in the digital age. You know, we lump together bit rot with format obsolescence, with evil Facebook and evil Google, and the worries about the cloud, and, you know, who's, and it's just all, you know, just completely into this festering mess of negativism. And none of this is, like, rational. And, you know, it's so new. We can't make any of these statements on, like, 15 years acquaintance or 20 years acquaintance with digital technology. We're just going to have to let it shake out. And believe me, it's no disaster if stuff gets lost. People will remember a lot. There will be many backups. We're just not going to be able to deal with exabytes of crud, you know. We just have to get over it. I really think.
Could you speak
more to the point?
No. More to the issue of, well, I don't know if. I don't know if format obsolescence is too specific an issue, but to me that's one that I find interesting. So the idea is that, you know, if you try to open a Microsoft Word document from 8 years ago, you know, you're going to have a hard time. Or if you can do it, of course, but, you know, the idea is that then over time, the farther we get away from Microsoft 3.1, it's going to be very hard for the average person, whatever, to open it. Is there no heat there at all? I mean,
it's a really big issue. It's a consumer issue, actually. It's where the rubber meets the road. But consumers don't seem to be, you know, we endure the hassles that our computers make us go through. And one of the ways we're going to start dealing with format obsolescence is the whole personal archives thing, which is a huge business waiting to happen. Now, Facebook tried to co-opt that a couple weeks ago, and they introduced the timeline, which most people haven't seen yet because it isn't on most people's Facebook accounts, and I quit Facebook, so I only can, like, read about it. But, you know, that's a framework on which you can upload pictures, words, audio, movies, what websites you visit. A lot of it is put on your timeline without you having a role, and you know you have to navigate this bizarre set of permissions and which nobody really understands. But there's going to be a huge business of like this digital locker thing where you upload your stuff to somebody, and Google will probably offer it for free if you want to trust them. Other people who maybe you trust more will be offering it, but this will kind of be the crux of a lot of that. Who do you want to house your personal information, and under what circumstances do you want other people to look at? And this is a really interesting and very political question now, you know, given the asymmetry of information, who can see into your life and where we cannot see ourselves.
Does but to me, it still seems like we're still in the potential, have the potential for a digital dark age if we're entrusting our files, our personal archives to a corporation. We're trusting that they're going to be there forever and that they're always going to keep the stuff and give us access to it. It seems like we're still in the same boat. We don't really have control over our own stuff.
I really love digital dark age. It reminds me of another term, bibliohysteria, which was, you know, the loss of the books that when I went to library school, there were going to be no more books. So we had to learn really quickly how to navigate the newly formed World Wide Web so that we could serve people and the public because there was no more books. It hasn't really happened that way. You have a pop-up bookstore. Maybe it's a reliquary of sorts. But in a weird way, that hysteria is part of the equation for me when I have like this sort of long-term arc of archives, I think in terms of glaciers. It's like a forest, some things burn and then other things grow. There's a long-term sort of, things will happen and we will lament them, but overall we're not gonna lose our entire cultural heritage to a corporation when Google goes under. We're all gonna be a little pissed. Some of us will have our stuff on our own hard drives that will be like, thank God I backed up my stuff on my own hard drive. Or, you know, there's gonna be other ways around these sort of monolithic things like Facebook. But I think what we're gonna have to be a little more vigilant about is you know, I'm on the other side of the privacy thing where I'm a little freaked out all the time. And then now I'm like, God, I'm going to go home and commit Facebook suicide because I don't want all my stuff out there. But it does seem like there's a way that this hysteria about losing everything is just as, you know, I remember lamenting microfilm the same, you know, that we had microfilmed things and now the microfilm has scratches and now it's no longer, you know, so we've been through this format change a lot, I guess, in archives. And we sort of see it as like, okay, now we're going to deal with this. And I think Rick is right. We're always playing catch up. Maybe if we were more on the front end of that equation and making decisions as culture is produced about where it's going to go and how it's going to, you know, be taken care of, I think that would be a better thing. Maybe archivists should be not in the back room taking care of the outmoded and outdated, but rather producing, you know, the cages that we're going to hold on the data. I don't know, you know, in real time.
That's when, you know, the digital archivists now talk about digital curation because you can't tag the fire hose. You know, there's just so much digital material being produced. They're talking about collecting it and curating it at the point of reception. The digital dark age, you know, I'm really uncomfortable with that because it posits that there's a real problem. And then we look for somebody to save us. And it's always the wrong person. And I really wouldn't underestimate human agency, and I wouldn't underestimate geeks. You know, I think of like, GeoCities was closing down, and Jason Scott, you know, the archive team at TextFiles on Twitter, who's this extremely in-your-face guy, super proactive, he and a group of volunteers saved GeoCities. It's up on the Internet Archive. Google Video closed down. They crawled it and saved it. Same with Yahoo Video. And you can bet that if Facebook, for some reason, develops feet of clay and begins to disappear, people will try to save it. And by the way, you know, you can download your personal information off of Facebook. That's actually quite simple to do. And you get a lovely little file, and you can look back on every message you've ever sent and see all the pictures and get a list of all your friends. And yes, you can't do very much with it because it's in a weird format, but you can save it. You can print it out if you want. And then, you know, if you leave, it's there. you have it.
Do you think any of these issues will affect the, if we could get back to the personal archive, you talked about the history of the everyday, and that's also been really instrumental in writing these other histories that have been absent for so much of our historiography. And I'm wondering if there are any implications for personal histories or labor histories or other histories that the digital, I mean, I guess especially with the personal histories, are we going to come across the diary in whatever form that is, computer form, 50 years from now? Or is this something we just shouldn't worry about, and whatever shakes out will shake out?
A little bit of both. I mean, I'm an archivist, and I can't even get the photos off my old digital camera, and they're gone to me. So I think that there's obsolescence always happening, but there's also a sort of endless openness that things are being pushed out into. I definitely get your trajectory with obsolescence and technology. I mean, certainly it's very difficult to keep up with the likes of Microsoft, we have to always realize that these corporations have nothing but profit as motive. So they're always going to try and sell us the next thing. And so that always necessarily means obsolescence, because you have to want the next thing. But there's also, on the other side of that, things like Open Office and other tools that are trying to sort of counter that with open source. And there are virtual machines that we're coming up with in the archives, in the back rooms of the National Archives, et cetera, where they're trying to actually simulate every sort of platform ever. That said, I've had collections with floppy disks that we basically shove the floppy disk in a folder and just say, we have no idea what's in it because we don't have a floppy drive to read that. You can send it out when a researcher finally comes in who says, I really want to know what's on there. And some geek, which we'll give a lot of credit to, will say, you know what, I have that exact, Commodore 64, whatever, that can read that, and he'll format it for you and but it is increasing. I mean, it's very difficult when you can serve someone, say, an 1849 letter, and you can serve it a million times, and it's never going to change, and it's always going to be the same. And you have this other collection that was created 5 years ago, and you can't read part of it. I mean, that is there.
Yeah.
I hate to sound like one of the, letters to the editor in the Chronicle, where everybody, people always say, well, people have to assume greater personal responsibility. That seems to be the theme, but in fact, it's true with our archival material. We can't keep outsourcing cultural memory to people that don't get rewarded adequately. In fact, they get marginalized, and who don't get our self-respect. I've been in academic conferences where scholars get up and they really hassle archivists for not collecting enough. You mean this isn't around? You mean you didn't collect that? And they hassle librarians because resources aren't there. And it's, a classic case of outsourcing work that's about maintaining society to a group that's composed predominantly of women, that tends to be lower echelon within cultural institutions. I always admire the scholars that collect their own material, like entomologists or linguists or folklorists, where they're not. And I think all of us have to take responsibility for what we want to save, and that's the kind of ethic that may actually, it's completely decentralist, but ultimately these collections do find their way into more, institutions that actually can protect them against water, fire, and perhaps combat.
Is that speak to the paradigm shift that you were talking about earlier, or is that your paradigm shift, or did you have more in mind when you said that at the beginning?
Oh, you mean my My breaking the rules?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you know, Tanya has spoken quite eloquently of the backlog and of the proliferation of analog records that are being created now. And this is a really big problem because digital is so hard to deal with that it's beginning to occupy almost a disproportionate amount of people's time and effort. There's a huge industry of people who are spending their time working on metadata, on digital longevity, on translation, on migration. And I believe, and you know, people who are working archivists in this group probably won't agree, that what we've got to do in order to get all this physical processing done is begin to develop participatory physical archives where people with essentially minimal training are actually able to touch material and start to work with it. I think in many cases, and I mean, I'm speaking as somebody who has over 7,000 home movies, and there's just no way, you know, that I'm going to be able to deal with this in a like 1.5-person organization. And so I think the next step is actually finding ways to let the public in the back room and get them involved in touching material and helping it get organized, conserved, contextualized, and ready. So if you're researching a topic, you might actually be the person who processes that collection. This has typically not happened.
Yeah, well, for me, it's been sort of something throughout my career. When I was at Bancroft, I invited the Spicer editors, Jack Spicer's poetry, to come in and help me process, because I don't know, they didn't even know what Spicer was doing and what hope did I have. So that, and also around the People's Temple collection at CHS, the only people who could identify the people that were in those photos were the people who were in Jonestown. So you always have to rely, I think, on that public input for identification. But I agree, there's always room. In fact, my boss, Catherine, is here. And having people from the unions interview other people in the union, or someone who's a researcher who's interested in gay labor history going out and doing oral histories for us. I mean, there's ways that we're already trying to do these things, but and there are archives that are intentionally sort of creating a track. On the other side of that equation, there's a lot of work involved for the archivist to actually oversee that work. You know, a volunteer is only a volunteer to a manager. But to us, it's basically you're hand-holding and you're helping and you're guiding and you're teaching the entire time. So it isn't always, but they know more often, so you have to direct them. But you're getting, I would say, such a rich product from them that it's worth it.
Well, we've hit our 45-minute allotment because we wanted to leave time because we knew there was going to be a lot of archivists in the audience. So we'd love to open it up for questions. So or comments. Yeah.
So if there is this idea of you wanting to save something as opposed to you not caring or hoping that it's destroyed, are there
say you archivist or you
as a, let's say, collector or individual.
Okay.
Are there self archiving documents, or are there self curating collections? I mean, what in this space have you seen that works? Is tagging worth it, basically?
I mean, so Kenny Goldsmith, you know, Ubu.com, actually wrote an essay about this. I think it's in his new book, and it's not bad, but it talks about the functions of archival work that have been assumed by ordinary citizens now. A lot of it is this notion of collecting. How do people collect their bookmarks? How do people organize their digital lives? There's already a lot going on there. If you look at the scrapbooking movement, which, you know, the modern scrapbooking movement began among women in the Church of Latter-day Saints, essentially a celebratory family thing. That has incredible implications for not just personal archiving, but, you know, scrapbooks are also like mashups in the same way that quilts are remix work, you know, and it's really interesting to start thinking of. So there's actually a lot going on right now, and, you know, tagging is one of a number of things that helps to bring order to chaos.
I would say all the information that you provide on any sort of document you produce, whether it's digital or otherwise, is going to have, if it stays with the object, whether it's a digital object in its form of metadata about that object, or it's, you know, your handwriting on the back of a printed photo, it makes a huge difference on whether that image is worth, you know, if it's two guys standing in front of a, you know, a boat, we're going to say two guys in front of a boat when we title it. But if it's John Doe and his brother in 1964 on their camping trip to the Kings Valley, whatever, you know, it, the more data you can pack in there, the better, because then all that stuff is harvested in searches. And so, you know, you may think no one really cares, but someone may be looking for that exact photo in 50 years.
And, you know, machines are never going to solve this problem as well as we'd like, but they could already do a lot of things. I mean, you can have, we're doing a home movie digitizing project at Internet Archive, and I want to make it to have one common format that machines can look at, and they can tell you black and white or color. They can look at an edge code and tell you the date that the film was made. They can see, are these people, are these animals, is it inside, outside? And this doesn't tell you what's there, but it allows you to take a billion things and put them into a bunch of buckets, which are each just millions of things. And that, even that, is a step forward. And we're going to see a lot more. I mean, you know, Google has face recognition that they haven't even turned on because it's too creepy.
I just wanted to follow up on the issue of citizens as subject experts. That one of the, I mean, a lot of the discussions have been sort of on the gloom and doom, the downside of digital archiving, but there's some real upsides. I mean, there are tools that are cheaper that didn't exist 10 years ago. You can get an 11 by 17 inch scanner for $150. And one project I'm working on at the museum is putting up thousands of posters from the 60s and 70s. And by doing so, you can crowdsource content. People come forward and say, oh, I did that anonymously in 1970. Mm. And it would never happen otherwise if it were sitting in an archive as an object. And so there's some real upsides to digitization and releasing stuff with skeleton cataloging. Just having the basics out there and people will find it, and then you'll get this stuff coming in. So the interactivity of the web, in some ways, makes some of this material easier to catalog than it ever was before. And you can draw out stories and build community in a really rich and positive way. So I'm actually really excited about this period in history as an archivist, because there's things you could never have done before.
I really agree, and the reuse and incorporation of material that's available on the public web into new works, I think this has only just begun. I mean, I'm so amazed by what use is made of our material. You should see how many remixes there are of the Market Street 1906 film and what people do with it. It's astonishing, because that film is like the entry point for like archival consciousness for a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't touch it. So I totally agree.
When you hear people talking about archives, you often hear these two very different accounts. That on the one hand, the archive is like this place of plenitude, where these lost histories are sort of a place of recovery, where accounts or people's lives, especially when you think of things coming out of like the rights movements of the 70s, like the Queer Archive or the archive that represents African American history or slavery. So it's like this site of plenitude. But on the other hand, it's often sort of posed as a site of loss. And so I'm just wondering how you can sort of think through that paradox around how the archives are perceived. Or if you think about it as that it's always going to be this incomplete set of records, that it's both those things.
Well, I think... So two things, I guess. Hi, Jocelyn. I can't see your head. I think that a lot of what archives come out of is that feeling of loss. And so we work very hard to recover. We work really hard to fill those gaps that are often painful. We also, I mean, when I think about the 70s and particularly the rights movements, when the same sort of revolutions were happening in archives where they were looking for these public histories within sort of the dead white guys' histories. So you would find the one line about the slave getting sold, and you would finally have a name for a slave that could then follow into a family history of that person, or indentured, you know, documents of indenture for Chinese laborers, and suddenly you have this amazing document with a photograph attached for a family. So there was a huge... That loss was felt, not always, I think, in the United States. And then suddenly there was a recognition of loss, that we don't have any women's voices, we don't have any workers' voices. And there was a recovery through even just re-examining the documents we had already saved. And so that high idea of public history was born of actually just recasting what was already there. So that came out of loss, I would say. But I think the pain of loss is sort of what keeps every single one of us archiving every day, that sort of sense of hedging your bets against loss, or that you will disappear, that we are disappearing at all times. And maybe you can speak to that more romantic notion.
You know, I used to collect industrial films, and we had quite a lot of industrial films, and people came to us looking for footage, and they said, do you have footage of African American life in the 20th century? And we said, well, you know, not too much. And we began, and obviously this was a negative attribute of our collection, but in another way, if you think of our collection as intense, obsessive self-documentation of whiteness and white privilege in 20th century America, then suddenly, if you decide to unpack that, then you're doing some pretty valuable work. And I mean, I look at a lot of sad home movies all the time, but I have to say, I actually find it one of the most life-affirming and exciting processes when I'm scanning a home movie that I haven't looked at. And as something that's in a can on celluloid, that's like really hard to deal with, hard to show, hard to touch, hard to take care of, as it turns into bits that can be put on the public web and that just about anybody can do anything with, I am just constantly excited. I can't tell you the level of excitement that I run into finding these. You know, today I was doing stuff for this local history event that I'm going to do in Detroit in 2 weeks, and some home movies of a fairly wealthy African American family turned up in a basement somewhere. We don't know who they are, and they're meeting at a historically black fraternity meeting in Detroit, and the footage is astonishing, and I can't wait to show it in Detroit, and I can bet you that somebody in the audience is going to know who some of these people are. And that, to me, yes, these people lost their films. Who knows what family disruption or fracture led to these films ending up in a basement? But on the other hand, there's going to be a reclamation process. You know, Detroit is going to take this stuff back, and to me, that's like incredibly formative and exciting.
Yeah, I would say probably the most moving sort of topic for me around loss was the People's Temple. Obviously, everyone that is still alive that was in Jonestown felt the loss every day. And so you were looking at these absences literally in the face, because they had photos of everyone that had gone, and dealing with loss and positing replacements for loss, surrogates for loss. That's sort of what the archives does, is often I likened working on a collection with being a roommate for someone who's gone. So there's this giant absence in the middle, but I know everything else about that person. One of my big collections was David Brower, the head of Sierra Club, and I felt like I lived with him, but I had never met him. I probably knew more about him than his wife at the end there. And, you know, so there is this sense that in the center is a loss, but around that accumulates a lot of other things that aggregate into a picture or a fuller set of feeling and sentiment and history, you know, in a more sort of general sense of human narrative.
There's a hand in the way back there.
Yeah, thanks. I think this discussion that we're having right now points to maybe a spectrum of affective impulses behind archives. So when you talked earlier, Rick, about having a scholar in every schoolhouse or a person of letters in every town, I think that this idea of all of the individuals rather than institutional archives or maybe collective archives can have different affective motors. So on the one hand, you could have one about trying to stem some kind of loss. Another could be a kind of excitement or passion. Another could be a political campaign to wider representation of some topic. So for me, I've always been inspired by Edward Said's BBC Rave lecture, which was called Representations of the Intellectual, where he talks about the amateur instead of the academic. Amateur from love, you know, from the Latin root. But hate could be equally an affective impulse behind creating an archive. So I think this idea of a paradigmatic shift could be moving from an institutional perspective to an individual or collective responsibility or interest in developing these archives and then sharing them with each other, having times where you invite people over instead of maybe having a protest, having a time when you open your archive to others to share what you've collected and to say, look, this is available for you. So I definitely think that the spectrum is actually extremely important, and to recognize and legitimate all of those different impulses because they're all quite valuable.
Having worked in large institutions and small ones, the legitimacy of an institution often stifles that impulse. And I think that some of the best collections are those unhindered collections where, you know, when you said motivated by hate, I was thinking of sort of the more paranoid collections that I've seen in my life where it's actually just an obsession with proving something wrong or proving, you know, something that actually you're like, okay, I don't know that this is actually true, but this man spent 40 years of his life trying to prove it. And looking at that aggregation as a documentation of this crazy question, but also this crazy person and whether he was crazy or not. I mean, maybe he wasn't, and he had the answer. And if we just looked through this archive, we would know. So I think when the institution takes it up, there's so many pressures for what gets processed in terms of monetary. You know, if you purchase the papers of big, giant named poet versus guy who wants to prove something about the JFK conspiracy, that big poet's going to get processed first. So, you know, there's all kinds of institutional weight that comes to bear. And kind of when it's outside the institution is when it is more wild, and maybe that guy digitizes it all and puts it all out there, and maybe that's all it needs because then it has a much larger life than going into the archives. Not that I'm... There's a little bit of both, I think. But I think there is something called, like, ecstatic archiving that needs to happen where you aren't thinking about the end result of it being in an archives. And many writers are now writing toward the archives, literally with the mind toward selling by the linear foot to archives. And I think having someone whose goal is purely outside of history, but rather for their own goal or whatever their aim is, I think that's important.
But I just kept thinking about, you know, computer technology, as we keep talking about it as something that doesn't necessarily work for preservation, but how great it is for access. And I just want to, like, reiterate that. I mean, when that, what is that Herzog maybe about the caves? I mean, you know, who's going to see that, right? But then when I saw that, it's like, I was never going to go to those caves and see it. So I guess I feel like, yeah, you open that can of film and you digitize it, and maybe it'll only last a couple of years and then we run out of fossil fuel, but, like, all these people have seen it and it lives in their memory or it turns into something else. And I think that archives have a lot to do with sort of present day engagement and, yeah, cultural engagement
production.
I don't want to even say production because I'm so tired of thinking about art and activity is production, but, you know, activities that we do privately or together or whatever. And I think that's another place that archives is actually working.
I think it's a really extremely strong point. I think it's one of the reasons that no matter how dystopian this world may seem to be getting, it's never been a more exciting time culturally. And so much of that is because of this simultaneity of past and present, that so much of the historical and cultural record is touchable at this point. But more, you know. Yeah, well, you know, Fahrenheit 451, there's corollaries to this idea that there's an archive in Texas. A woman named Caroline Frick started an archives called the Texas Archives of the Moving Image, TAMI, and she wrote a book, which is, it's one of the most radical books I've ever seen about film preservation. And she says, you know, this idea of preserving film to film, that access is actually preservation, and if stuff is out there, and if it's in consciousness, and if it's in memory, it's actually preserved. And, you know, this is human agency rather than cans sitting on shelves. And I mean, I know it's a metaphor and everything, but it's really worth taking, you know, further. We want to do what we can to create historically and culturally conscious people in the domains in which we live. And that's what archives, yeah.
I really just think of memory as that sort of, you know, the magic tablet that's peeled away. But you know, the imprint is still there, and we're all carrying that. It becomes part of our DNA and our visual memory, and it's all accrued into what we are as humans. And so I think that that's, yeah, having, even if it's a fleeting moment of seeing something, it's taken up into our bodies and put out there again as we speak. And no, I think you're right, Wendy. Another archivist. There's a lot of us in the room. Can we all just raise our hands? Because we're so amazing. Yeah. Give us a hand.
Well, thank you all for coming. I'm sure Rick and Tanya will hang out here for a bit. And once again, we're open for another 10 days, and we have a couple more events. So feel free to hang out. Thanks.